Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're very excited about the upcoming James Beard Foundation Awards, which happen annually. And usually we cover them live, which we will also do again this year. But we also wanted to give you some advance heads up, I guess is the proper terminology, so that you can actually join in this excitement and fun by purchasing a ticket. So we're talking to the executive vice president of the James Beard Foundation.
Yeah, Dr. Mitchell Davis.
Dr. Mitchell Davis, who is always the calm guiding force at these events, and you can't fail to notice him when everybody else is flapping around aimlessly. He's standing very unflappably in control of the situation.
But he's been doing this for
a while. He's been doing it for a long time, yeah, and he's the perfect one to give us an overview of the event.
Hold on a second. There's a particular reason why we're doing it this particular time around in this year of our Lord 2012, because with James Beard Arithmetic, which is not exactly the same as decimal arithmetic, it's the 25th anniversary of the James Beard Foundation Awards, even though they started giving them out in 1991. So go figure that one out if you can. So it's going to be an especially big party, an especially celebratory event. And not only is it marked by a 25th anniversary extravaganza, but also by the publication of a book. A book project conceived.
Which I love this book.
Yeah, conceived by the author herself, Kit
Wall. Kit Wall, who is a very recognized and authoritative writer, very talented, who is a native New Orleans, actually, Norlean.
Yeah, whatever that has to do with it.
But it was her idea, and we talked to her about this book, which is just
and it's totally,
majorly impressive.
It totally exceeded, I think, her expectations, the foundation's expectations, certainly our expectations. It's a magnificent piece of food literature filled with fascinating recipes and the stories of 25 fascinating people who just happen to share one thing in common. They've all been James Beard Foundation Best Chef of the Year. In fact, a couple of them even more than once.
Yes.
So you'll want to hear that too. And both of these things, Mitch Davis and Kit Wall, will be before the break.
Mitchell Davis, welcome to On the Menu. You're going to talk to us and our listeners about this great event coming up, which is the James Beard Foundation Annual Awards. You are the foundation's vice president, and what is your title now?
it's vice president. They stuck the word executive in front of it. I'm not quite sure what that means, except that they give me more to do. I've been here 19 years, so I've been part of a lot of the past history and the recent history, which has been very exciting. It's our 25th anniversary this year,
yes,
as I know you know.
Which is why this upcoming event is really so important. For those who don't know, what exactly is the mission, as briefly as you could put it, of the James Beard Foundation?
Well, officially, the way it's written is it's to celebrate, nurture, and preserve America's diverse culinary heritage and future. So what that means is we support chefs, we give out scholarships to culinary students, who are the future. We actually put on the awards, which helps shine a spotlight on all of the great talent, in not just in the restaurant and chefs, but in food books and on TV and on radio, like this wonderful show. And then we also now do a series of educational food systems work, conferences and meetings, to try to help move our food system sort of into the place we all want it to be in the future.
Well, it's the go-to association for anybody interested in things culinary, and you're doing the 25th anniversary, and the big gala is coming up, and tell us about that. It's May 7th?
Sure, yeah, the big awards at Lincoln Center happen on May 7th. It's a red carpet gala, as you said, and that's where we give out the restaurant and chef awards. And everyone who's sort of anyone in the food world is there. This, because it's our 25th anniversary, that's what we're looking. We're looking back at the outstanding award winners from the last years. We actually have only given out awards for 22 years, so the math is a little complicated. But yeah, there's a lot of great chefs coming back, former award winners, and then all of the food celebrities that we know and love on all sorts of different media. I should also say that on May 4th, are the Beard Books Broadcast and Journalism Awards, and that's another huge evening. It's a dinner and another wonderful night of celebration.
Yes, this is all very exciting. We are going to be interviewing Kit Wall about this, the 25th anniversary publication, which is a masterpiece. It's a gorgeous book.
Thank you very much. Yeah, well, they're gorgeous and wonderful chefs, and so it's easy to make a nice book from them.
Well, now, who are some of the great names that are going to be there this year?
Well, on the stage, presenting awards, we're going to see all of our friends, Thomas Keller, Eric Repair. Actually, come to think of it, I think Eric is one of the few who has a previous engagement. Charlie Trotter, Lydia Bastianich, Wolfgang Puck will be in the house. All the greats from the ages.
And who's going to be cooking?
The reception that happens after the ceremony is interesting because we're celebrating Beard, and so we've asked a bunch of chefs to cook recipes inspired from Beard's books. James Beard wrote 24 or so cookbooks, and we've got Sean Brock from Charleston, from McCready's coming, and Gary Danko, who's a Beard Award winner. He's coming from San Francisco. Paul Kahan, another award winner from Chicago.
These are all those guys.
Yeah, they're the ones who'll be cooking the food after the ceremony.
Yeah, and the ceremony takes place, then there's the strolling dinner party, and then there are like endless after parties.
Well, you know, when you bring 2,000 food people and chefs and together in one town, in New York particularly, they know how to have a good time. And it really starts on Friday and goes all the way through till Tuesday morning. And if your stamina is good enough, you could be eating and drinking the entire time.
Yeah.
And you'll be there leading the pack, of course.
I'm actually working, but, you know, we'll be there making sure everyone has a good time.
I bet I'll see you with a glass in your hand, nevertheless.
Yeah, once we give out the last award, then we're free to have a good time ourselves.
Yeah.
So.
Now, how do people get tickets, Mitchell?
It's easy, actually. You just go to jamesbeard.org. That's our website for the whole organization. You can see all about us, and you can purchase tickets online right there. You'll see, actually, we've redone the website recently, and it's much easier to find all the wonderful things that are going on, and sort of a history of American culinary heritage is at your fingertips.
Now, I mean, the results are really kept top secret, aren't they?
Absolutely. I do not know them until they are read on stage. I have no desire to know, to make, you know, you see a lot of people and you never know, my brain doesn't work well enough. After 19 years, it's like one long awards program, so I never know which is the right year and who's nominated or won what. So they keep us in the dark on purpose. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to being there, seeing you again. Don't get to see you much during the year.
No, but we squish ourselves into the press room and try to get our work done. And as you know, it's a party everywhere, including behind the scenes. Sometimes difficult for those of us who are filing stories and doing interviews.
Oh, yeah, but, I know. I mean, I just interviewed somebody who said that. I said, "Deb, I met you before," and she said, "Yes, I tramped on you by accident last year." Which
yeah,
is
a
what
lot of tramping.
Zoo. Yeah.
Yeah,
and it's Avery Fisher Hall at Lincoln Center, and it's black tie. It's very glam and festive. Mitch, thank you for coming on and talking to us about this event, and I look forward to having everybody check out the tickets. It's the Oscars of the food world, and everybody should join in.
And of course, we look forward to seeing you, Peter, and everybody else.
Yeah, we'll be there with bells on, as usual.
Great.
Thanks, Mitch.
Thank you.
Kit Wall, you dreamed of this project, and boy, did it turn out as probably one of the most handsome cookbooks, not just cookbooks, it has more than just recipes in it. The James Beard Foundation's Best of the Best 25th Anniversary Celebration of America's Outstanding Chefs. Now, I think most people understand that, but if there's somebody out there who doesn't, how did you go about this? This was the Outstanding Chef of the James Beard Awards every year since when?
Since they started giving the Outstanding Chef Award. I think that was not long after they began the James Beard Foundation.
1991.
21 years, 22 years.
Yeah, 1991 was Wolfgang Puck. So you went to all these chefs, and all of them are alive except for one.
For Jean-Louis Paladin.
Yeah, who we adore, I know. And so how did this proceed? Process has to be as interesting as the content.
Well, obviously the James Beard Foundation is revered by all of these chefs, and Susan Ungaro kicked the doors open for me, and then we proceeded to set up appointments with each of the chefs to visit them, cook with them, interview and photograph them. So for me, it was a two-year magical pilgrimage.
Now, the photographs are extraordinary. The photographer?
That was Susie Kushner.
She is just wonderful. And you have a foreword by Martha Stewart, and then also an introduction by Susan Ungaro, And also Mitch Davis, who's the vice president of the James Beard Foundation.
Two of the best people in the world.
Yes, both of them. And then each chef for each year, you do a profile, right?
We sat down and got to know the chefs, interviewed them, played, had a great time, cooked, ate.
And then you ate all these dishes too, huh?
Absolutely. You have to. You have to.
Of course you have to. I'm looking at the pizza with smoked salmon and caviar, which looks just horrible. Yes, that of course is the Wolfgang Puck. I wanted to just mention that you did have a chef working with you on this, Chef Robert Barker, who actually just after the project finished or just before?
Just after the project.
Just after died. And you come up, you give a dedication of this book in memory of him, which is, it was sad, but it's, I'm so glad you thought to do that.
He was trained by both Wolfgang Puck and by Emeril, just a magnificent chef. And the happy thing is he spent the last 2 years of his life cooking with the very best chefs in the country. So it doesn't get a lot better than that.
And it speaks to the fact that you can trust these recipes, right?
Absolutely. That was the point. He enjoyed traveling, but he enjoyed really being in the kitchens.
Now, who picked the recipes?
The chefs did.
Okay, so you just said,
pick
your favorite.
Give us what represents your work.
Okay, well, okay. Well,
that must have been hard. Best represents your work.
Wouldn't that be a hard thing to do as a chef, huh?
Oh, I think so. It would drive me crazy.
What did you find out as you were talking to these chefs? Anything? Because you've been in this field for a long time.
Well, actually, it's something I did not consider when we started the project, and it revealed itself probably midway through the writing process. But what it is a trajectory of how American food has evolved over the last 25-year period.
How would you say that is?
To me, that was riveting.
Could you sort of give us an example of how this is evolving, what to what?
For example, when Wolfgang started and Jeremiah Tower, Alfred Portali, several of our chefs who were early year winners, when they began cooking, they had to go out and source their fresh products, which they had learned to do from their European background.
Right.
Either they came from Europe or they had done their apprenticeships in Europe. So they came here cooking across the country, frankly, East Coast and West Coast. They began seeking out farmers and asking them to help develop products. David Bouley actually stimulated the production of fingerling potatoes. Wolfgang sought out the lamb growers. Jean-Louis Paladin championed seafood and begged other chefs to buy from those purveyors so they'd be able to make a living. And then they got together with the winemakers and combined this tremendous force of food and wine and began doing events across the country to benefit various charities and civic causes. So that really brought food and wine into a whole new realm of excitement and into the forefront of the American consciousness. So today now, we have a completely evolved focus on fresh food, fresh products, and good wine, thanks to the men and women who started so many years ago. It's the same as it was, however, now it's much easier.
Now, a good many of these chefs are still active.
They're all still active but one.
And he has a good excuse, I guess.
He has a very good reason.
Yeah.
He and Robert are in heaven frying chicken.
There you go. Now, here's always the most difficult question, but I know you knew it must be coming. What are some of your favorites? I mean, you can't say I love all 25 of my children equally. That's not allowed.
Yes, I do. I love all of my children.
I understand, but which ones do you like best?
I think the person who brought things into focus for me just dramatically was Thomas Keller and, of course, Wolfgang Puck. I've known Wolfgang for years since he opened Espago. And then David Bouley took me on a magical trip in his test kitchen. He has a wonderful laboratory test kitchen set up. And then Danielle Ballou was just a gentleman beyond belief.
He's just amazing, isn't he? And he just keeps on cranking them out one after the other, and they're all great.
Yeah,
and Judy Rogers is a spectacular woman. When I grow up, I want to be just like Judy.
Yeah, and her cookbook has held up over the years, hasn't it?
Oh, she is such an inspiration.
Now, some of these are expected. I can't say expected, but I'm not surprised by some of the choices from the chefs. You say Wolfgang, of course he's going to put a pizza in there, even though it is revved up with smoked salmon and caviar. And Alice Waters is a fairly obvious one, too. She does a salad. and what else? The summer salad.
A beautiful apricot tart.
Oh, yeah, that's good. And who else would put in turnip and turnip green soup?
It was delicious, by the way.
I'll bet. But it fits her personality. Is there some choice that you were really surprised by in terms of the recipes?
Michelle Richard in Washington, who is also one of the most hysterically funny chefs I've ever met.
Yes, we've interviewed him. He's hysterical.
A wonderfully talented man. But in the book is his recipe for fettuccine Alfredo, and it's his sleight of hand trickery. It really is onion.
Oh, really? You mean
it's not pasta.
Oh, I'll be darned.
He slices onion very, very thin and poaches it, and then makes a beautiful Alfredo sauce. And when it's served to you, you think, my goodness, here it is, fettuccine. Wrong.
Well, he does have a good sense of humor, doesn't he?
Oh, golly, he's great.
And listen, Lydia ought to thank you profusely. This is one of the best pictures I've ever seen of her, right? With that wonderful.
She is a lady beyond compare.
I know. I love her. We're pretty good friends here. She has this wonderful animal print scarf on. What are some of the...
I would take this book if I were a reader. And I would have it as a book to dream with. I'd have it on my coffee table. I'd have another copy in my kitchen to work from. And I'd use it as a travel log for the most magnificent foodie pilgrimage that you could possibly take.
That's good. And that's going to be in response to my question. How should people use this book?
And I think you just answered it.
Take your appetite on an adventure.
Because you're from New Orleans, so you know just a little bit about food.
We love food, and we're not proud about that.
Now, you said you did admit that one of your favorites is not yet in the book. I guess when you do the 50th anniversary with 50, surely Donald Link will be in there.
Hoping we're both here to see that.
Yeah, they didn't note that. Since this, you finished with 2010, and then last year, 2011, was Jose Andres.
And we just finished interviewing him, and that will be on the Beard blog, the Beard website.
Oh, good. Okay.
So you're going to find another way to do this project that means you don't have to wait 25 years. What a great...
Absolutely. I should hope so.
Sounds like a great thing. Listen, we're going to catch up with you in the Crescent City in a few weeks, we hope, at the New Orleans Wine and Food Experience. And in the meantime, thank you so much for joining us here on the menu today.
And bring your appetite with you to New Orleans.
Oh, we always do. And, Kit, it is just a handsome, handsome book.
Thank you so very much. It was the culmination of a lot of dreams and a lot of book of record for how American food became great. We wanted the readers to get to know the chefs and their food, to give a feeling of their establishment's ambiance and the excitement and the means to recreate their specialties at home and, of course, commemorate the James Beard Foundation's 25th anniversary.
Well, that sums it up, and as I said before, this book is a keeper.
Thanks, my dear.
Thank you.
Bye.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, listeners. We're so glad you're with us today. And we do want to mention something else before Anne takes over again. We have not stopped our London coverage. We simply decided we would rest it for a week so we could bring you the story of the James Beard Foundation, which happens in that other great food city of the Western Hemisphere known as New York City. But we'll be back covering London again next week and a little bit probably the week after too. So if you're still tuning in on London, don't forget, next week we'll be resuming. And now in the meantime, back to the subject at hand, which is a slightly different take on the food
Marion
business.
Marion Nestle is certainly a standard bearer, as the James Beard Society is, on the food, the culinary scene. But she's an expert and has been fighting the very important battle of food politics. We're going to be talking to her about two books. One, her book entitled Food Politics, which is the predecessor book. And then this current book, which tackles the whole obesity issue and tells you just about, she just faces all the issues straight on, called Why Calories Count. She, I think, when she said, she's done us a great service, when she said that she feels that they've made great progress in evolving the whole food scene in this country, it's encouragement. And she's hanging in there, and so all of us should too. And here's Marion Nestle.
We have Marion Nestle on the program today, and Marion has a rather enormous following of devotees. And Marion, if you don't mind my saying so, I think it's because you have this voice of reason and common sense in the midst of the chaos of this whole controversy over food, politics, nutrition. You are a scientist. You also are a prolific writer. I'm looking at two of your books recently here. And I must say that the lecture I heard you deliver in San Francisco a while back was hilarious on a subject which could be less than hilarious about politics.
I think it's important to have a sense of humor about
it. Oh, that you took and dissected who's required to do what by way of analyzing a pizza, and I just howled through the whole discussion. The FDA this, and other people with this. But anyhow, you're now doing something. This latest book is called Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. And I think we probably ought to mention your co-writer, Malden Nesheim, is it?
Nesheim.
Yes, and you've worked with him before, and you work together very well, and you seem to be on the same page in this book.
Oh, yes, that's one of the reasons why we work together well, is because we have very similar attitudes about nutrition and very similar understanding of it.
Well, you know, when you pick up this book, you get to such basic definitions of things. It gives you pause to realize that most people don't have a clue or don't understand even the simplest reasons for why you eat, why you overeat, who controls the food environment. You go all the way back to Hippocrates.
Oh, yes, that was one of the most entertaining parts of doing this book, because I got to read Hippocrates and Galen for the first time. I was just amazed at what they knew and didn't know.
Right, but now, who did you write this book for?
Well, the book's for the general public, and I think anybody who's willing to read it and go along with it and struggle with the science a little bit will come out at the end and really understand what's going on now.
And do you think it will modify their behavior? Because you say that not necessarily so.
I think that people will. My experience with the books that I've written is that people read them and say, this was really helpful. It's the first time I've understood this, and now I know what I need to do. And they figure it out for themselves.
So you think this, knowing how calories work in the system, will lead people to eating more wisely?
I think it certainly will help them manage their weight better. And that's, calories are about weight. Weight is about calories is a better way to put it. And health is about eating better and making sure that those calories come from healthful foods. But these are two quite separate things. And once you understand that weight is about calories, and it doesn't matter where the calories come from the standpoint of weight, then you know that you just have to eat less if you're putting on pounds.
Right. My trainer and I go on about the way to make a fortune is to hit on an all-you-can-eat diet.
Yes, that's
the most preposterous thing.
Yes.
Well, that would be nice, wouldn't it be?
Yeah, I decided that it should be all you can eat, low-fat Twinkies and sauerkraut.
Well, that actually, the Twinkie diet's been done. And somebody went on a diet of just Twinkies and lo and behold, lost weight.
Yeah, that was the professor. Is that the one?
Yeah, of course he lost weight. He wasn't eating
much. Because he got really bored.
how many Twinkies can you eat?
Marion, you're a philosopher, you're a scientist, you're a very smart person. A lot of people obviously are not as smart as you are. But why is it seems that the statement you make is so obvious? If you eat more than you exercise off, you will gain weight. Why don't people understand that connection?
Well, I think there's a $60 billion diet industry that doesn't want you to have that message. You know, eating less is very bad for business, all kinds of businesses. And the food industry would love for you to think that their foods are calorie-free. That's what health claims are about. The diet industry would love for you to think that their particular way of going about this is going to be the secret to your success. And lots of people write books about dieting, and they depend on people believing that their particular approach is going to work. Nobody benefits if people do it themselves, except people themselves.
So it's just like, it's almost like a giant commercial conspiracy.
Well, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I just think that in the normal course of trying to make money in our current economy, people find different ways to do that, and a lot of people take advantage of people's difficulty with weight.
Well, now, overall, it seems that, you say since the 80s, that our populations, not just the U.S., but all across the globe, have a problem with weight. I mean, all of a sudden, is that because we have less expenditure of energy with modern conveniences, not a farm life? I mean, why is it that all of a sudden we have this epidemic?
Well, I think it has to do with business practices. There were three different kinds of deregulation that occurred in the early 1980s, or that was expressed in the early 1980s. One was deregulation of the way we do farm support. So instead of paying farmers not to grow food, we paid farmers to grow as much food as they possibly could. And the result was an enormous glut and overproduction of food in the United States. And the number of calories per person in the food supply went from 3,200 in 1980 to 3,900 in the year 2000. That was one kind. A second kind had to do with what happened on Wall Street. Wall Street stopped valuing blue chip stocks as the best possible stocks that you could buy, and instead began promoting a kind of approach to investment that would give investors immediate high returns on invest. That was as a result of something called the shareholder value movement. And the result of that was that companies not only had to make a profit, but they had to grow their profits and show growth to Wall Street every 90 days. That was particularly difficult for food companies who were already trying to peddle their product in an environment in which there was far too much food available. And then the third kind was something that gave food companies a little break, and that was the deregulation of marketing, particularly of marketing to children, so that food companies could now invest in marketing to children and seek new audiences that way. And the result was a completely changed society, which we didn't notice at the time. But food, which used to be restricted to certain kinds of places for sales, suddenly became available anywhere, everywhere. You go into any drugstore now and it looks like
yes.
a grocery store. A Staples, a business supply store, looks like a grocery store.
Target.
Bed Bath and Beyond. All of these places are selling food. And the research shows that the more food that's available and the closer it's at hand, the more people buy of it.
You managed to clarify a lot of confusions in this book. Overall, though, in your research, you said you enjoyed reading Hippocrates and so forth. In your research, did you discover anything new?
Well, I'm not sure about new. I think putting it together in this way is new. And doing it in a way, there's no other book like this anywhere. Each one of our little short chapters was a major literature review, and putting it together in a way that kind of came to the bottom line. I think the thing that surprised me the most, and that I wasn't really very well aware of, was the extraordinary difference between calories that are measured in food or in the body and those that are estimated by people eyeballing or sort of guessing at what they're looking at, or even calorie labels for that matter. There's a really, really big difference. Everybody underestimates what they're eating.
Oh, yes.
And I was surprised by, I was not familiar with the literature on measurement of calorie use by the body until I was doing the research for this book, and was astounded to find out how much more people eat than they think they're eating.
Now, one of the things you touched on that I've been reading about a lot is that the body's basically set up to fight against weight loss. And all these pharmaceuticals are now trying to play with, perhaps, the various hormones in the brain that regulate eating as a way of overcoming this obesity epidemic. What do you think is going on there, and what do you think will happen with all that?
Well, everybody wants a silver bullet. Everybody wants, if I could just take a pill and I would stop being hungry, I wouldn't want to eat, I would know when it was time to stop, and I wouldn't gain weight, I could eat as much as I wanted and not gain weight. Everybody would love to have something like that. But the probability of finding something like that, I think, is extremely small. And the reason for that is that there are probably 100 hormonal and other kinds of factors that control body weight in the average person. And if you tamper with one of them, it's not going to make any difference because the system is redundant and others will come in to make up for whatever changes occurred. And that's because these factors are designed to make us hungry. If we don't have enough food around and we don't get enough fuel for our brain, our bodies tell us, eat, 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 eat. And all of these hormonal factors are set up to encourage us to eat more, not less. And they are much less effective at telling us when to stop. And so, in a sense, if we're trying to diet or trying not to eat, we're fighting our own biology.
Yes. I mean, that's sort of discouraging, I think.
That is discouraging. But you have to learn how to do that.
Yeah, and it gets worse if you've lost a whole bunch of weight.
It does, because then you don't need to eat as much.
You had some really interesting studies that you refer to on starvation. And I never knew that there were all these studies, that they actually deliberately tried to test out starving in humans.
Oh, my goodness, yes. I mean, there have been natural experiments with people who have unfortunately been caught in famines or some other situation where they were being deliberately starved. But the most important study that's ever been done on what happens when you don't have enough calories was done in the Second World War in Minnesota by a group of investigators who worked with conscientious objectors to put them on a diet that would restrict their calories so they would lose weight to the point of losing a quarter of their normal body weight.
Yes, you know, that was weird.
Really kind of amazing. And they studied these people like nobody has ever been studied before. And everything that we know about starvation is done through this extraordinary series of studies that were extremely well done. They were done by Ansel Keys during the Second World War.
Now, part of the deal was if you were allowed to be a conscientious objector, then you had to participate?
Well, you had some choices about what you could do, and these people volunteered for these particular studies. They almost all belonged to religious groups that were opposed to war on principle, and they were extremely dedicated and devoted to this study, even though it was just a miserable experience for them. I mean, they were really starved and looked in there. They looked like people in concentration camp, and yet someone wrote a book very recently, within the last 10 years, interviewing them, and they are extraordinarily proud of their participation in that study because so much was learned from it.
Now, you also touched on a subject that I found fascinating. I read an article in New York Magazine about it a long time ago, about these restricted calorie people. The story was about a dinner party that people came with their food and their food scales. And the idea is that you have to avoid anorexia, but if you get to the point where you have the least number of calories before entering into anorexia, you extend your life.
Yeah, and this has been shown in a lot of different kind of animals, rats, mice, and lots of other things. Whether it works in humans is really a big question. And the idea that the Calorie Restriction Society has is if you reduce your calorie intake to the point where you lose about 10% of your normal body weight, not 25%, which is what that study showed, but 10% of your body weight, that you'll extend your lifespan. And lots of investigators are studying these people to find out whether they live any longer than anybody else. I look at the curves of, I mean, first of all, not eating a lot or not having what a reasonable body weight is uncomfortable for a lot of people. So these are very dedicated people who are able to keep themselves below what they normally would weigh. But there they are. They're doing it. But I look at the curves of health or of various kinds of health indices or of mortality as a function of body weight. And what you see over and over again is that the longest lifespans and the best health are in the range of body weights considered normal, that is a body mass index of about 18 to 25 or 28 or somewhere in that range. Below a body mass index of 18, mortality starts to rise. And this has been seen over and over and over again, and it's not clear whether very thin people are sick people and that's why they're dying off, or whether there's something about not having a little cushion of fat on you that makes you more liable to become ill. But we don't know the answer to this question yet, and I'm really interested to see how those calorie restriction studies come out.
Yeah, I am too. I mean, I think they're OC, but that's all right. Go ahead, Peter.
OC?
Obsessive compulsive types. Okay. I mean, personality types is what I think.
Here was the section of the book I thought was the most interesting. So I want you to touch on a few of the things than you would in the frequently asked questions section, where you answer a number of things like, if you eat more slowly, will you not put on as much weight? I thought some of your responses were so scientifically accurate and sound that people ought to read this part. This ought to be mandatory reading for anybody who's overweight.
Oh, we had some fun with that.
I'm sure you did that too.
My favorite one was the one about the myth. It's the last one in the book. If you eat standing up, the calories don't count. If you eat off somebody else's calories, they're borrowed calories and they don't count. You know, if you eat your kid's food, it doesn't count because they're small calories, that kind of thing. We had a lot of fun with that.
I'm sure you did.
But these are my trainer, again, I introduced Katie, she gets these questions all the time. And she's, like, thrown up her hand. She now has another business. She has a bakery. Because no matter what she says, nobody follows what her advice is.
Uh-huh.
People don't want to admit it. They don't want to accept it.
I have one final question for you, Marion, because I think an awful lot of food companies must be trying to find where you live.
Oh, I'm afraid my life is an open book, I'm afraid.
But let me ask you this question. If you had to pick one company in the food industry that you think is doing the right thing rather than the wrong thing in dealing with humans and their weight, could you come up with one?
I don't think I could, because the whole point about weight loss is that you need to eat less. And that's not good for anybody, any food company. I don't blame food companies. They're in business. Their job is to make money. Their job is to sell more product. The only time I get really upset with them is when they advertise their product as weight loss products or as health food, when obviously they're not. So I get really annoyed with cereal companies that say that if you eat their cereal, you'll lose weight, when in fact you can't eat anything else, or you're using their cereal to replace two different meals. This is really about quantity of food. And so I don't think that the food industry has the solution to the obesity problem. People have to solve it for themselves. Eat real food. Avoid food products they can. And try to create a food environment that makes it easier for them to do that, which is where the get political part of our advice comes in.
Now, here's an interesting approach from Peter that's financially unsound, but nevertheless an interesting thought just to conclude our discussion. We just recently interviewed Jenny's Ice Cream in Columbus, Ohio, and I just opened a pint of Jenny's chocolate ice cream, and it is really absolutely the most delicious ice cream you've ever tasted in your whole life, but a pint costs $14.
Oh, that's a good disincentive.
What do you think? We ought to make food more expensive, and you think that would have an effect?
No, it's not an approach that I would particularly take, because I worry a lot that poor people need to be able to eat too.
Yes.
So Right. I'm not sure that's the approach that I would take.
No, well, it'll be interesting to see the results of the experiment in my native land, where the government has just decided that the way to stop people from drinking too much is to make alcohol even more expensive.
Well, that worked with cigarettes.
Yeah, that's why Peter's mother stopped smoking.
But people still have to eat.
Anyway, Anne had a final thought before we go.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I certainly enjoy your insights on Twitter, and I thought maybe you could give out your Twitter address.
Oh, it's Marion Nessel, at Marion Nessel.
Yes.
And my website is foodpolitics.com.
Right. Well, keep up the good work, Marion. I often wonder how you keep up your spirits and willingness to keep attacking and fighting these things.
Because so many good things are happening.
Yes.
We have a food movement now that's making enormous changes.
Right.
And I think there's every room for optimism.
Well, you certainly boost my spirits. Thank you for joining us on the menu.
My pleasure.
I think you should be grateful to have been in the presence of someone who's a real expert, but also someone who doesn't jump to conclusions about what the future is. So you may be sure there's another book coming from the same direction.
Oh, of course.
And more to this word of food politics that you'll see in the future. So stay tuned, because we'll have it here on the menu when that happens. Right?
Yes. And while everyone's absorbing this information,
it's time for a break.
Another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. What's next?
Well, we've been skirting around the issues of traditions, and if there's ever a tradition, it's Southern food. And yet, I think that our next guests are going to introduce us to a different aspect. Southern cooking has its traditions, but it's not a caricature of how it's sort of come out to be. And the Knipples have researched and brought forth
This is Paul and Angela,
and
right?
Angela Knipple have produced a book called The World in a Skillet that shows the evolution of Southern cooking and the Southern table through the arrival of immigrants from just about every place you could imagine.
And recent ones.
Recent.
So it's the world on a skillet, but it's a world skewed in the direction of people who've arrived in the United States
for various reasons
since the Vietnam War. So it's a recent version of America's melting pot. The South has become a truly fascinating story.
I want to say congratulations to Paul and Angela Knipple. I was so thrilled to get this book, you two. I get lots and lots of cookbooks, of course, and dozens of Southern cookbooks. After a while, they all look pretty much the same, if you know what I mean.
Yes, because people define the South by its past, and we tend to think of the South as being rather static, but that was one of the really exciting things for us with this book, is we were able to get out and show that the South is far from static.
Certainly is. Honestly, I spend a lot of time in the South. In fact, we have our children live in Greenwood, South Carolina, and we're always back and forth to New Orleans and Charleston. And there are things in this book that just flatten me I never thought of. So you've taken Southern cooking, Southern cuisine, from what was, I thought it was becoming sort of like caricature or a cliche as it was being defined by all your fellow Southern writers. And you've added a whole new dimension to it.
Well, I think it's easy for it to fall into that, but really you get out there in the trenches, there's so much more going on. And I think there are a lot of chefs out there who are seeing that and embracing that. And there are a lot of people bringing new flavors.
Right. Now, I have to say that we did have some inklings. For example, when we interviewed John Besh about his New Orleans, he has an entire section of Italian recipes and immigration to New Orleans. And he told us all about the Sicilian background. So that was interesting. And, of course, we knew Cajun, we knew African-American, we knew the Creole. But you have something from everywhere.
Yeah, hold on just a second, because the United States has always been known as the melting pot.
Right.
And so for a couple of centuries, it certainly was a melting pot. But then that sort of stopped, or at least it seemed to us that it had stopped, an influence on the cuisine had stopped, but you discovered something else altogether.
Definitely. And the South, we do start in the book with a section called We're All From Somewhere Else. And we do talk about how Southern cuisine is a product of the enslaved Africans, a product of the Native American, product of the European, all kind of coming together.
But yet, at this point, we ought to say we neglected to announce the title of your book, which is The World in a Skillet, subtitled A Food Lover's Tour of the New American South. And I think new is what you're trying to approach in this book. Is that correct?
It really is. The main focus of the book is about 40 immigrants who've only come here since the Vietnam War. And we really wanted to tell their stories and why they chose to come to the South in particular and what it means to them to be serving the food that they brought with them from their home countries to their new communities.
Right. And some of the old stuff, though, even I didn't know about. What is that rice cake thing?
Kalaw. It's an absolutely fantastic dish.
I've never had it, and I've spent lots of time in the South.
It's the grandmother to the beignet.
Uh-huh.
And the kalaw was an endangered dish because the reason you had not had it is because it was more of a family dish. And more of a dish that was just sold kind of on street corner. There is no Café du Monde selling kalaw. It's a very family thing.
So I could make it but not get it when I'm in the South.
Exactly. And Poppy Tooker, who's a huge food personality and very important in Southern food, of preserving Southern food and also looking to the future, is helping to bring back kalaw.
Well, I was fascinated with that.
It's a wonderfully easy dish. You take leftover rice, mix it together with a little flour, a little egg to bind it, sugar and cinnamon, and then you just deep fry them. Make them into little fritters and deep fry them. It's wonderful.
Now, you have a really nice introduction by John T. Edge. Isn't he a master of language, though?
He's wonderful, yes.
So, and you're tied in with the Southern Foodways group, right?
We are, yes. We had the good fortune of getting in with that bunch of folks, and we have just loved it. And they've been such an inspiration to us and such support.
Now, you said you focused on 40 individuals that you found who had a different ethnic heritage, but who had come to the United States. Now, how much of what they're doing is their native cuisine reproduced, and how much of it is a true fusion? One hates that fusion word, but nevertheless, it is a way of describing two things that have come together.
Well, actually, most of it is very authentic. We were actually surprised. We expected to see people adapting their cuisine more to Southern ingredients and to, you know, having trouble finding things. And really, we were amazed. Like, the Vietnamese community in New Orleans, they've got these wonderful community gardens that they're growing, and they've got people who brought seeds over with them from Vietnam. So they've got their produce, their native produce from Vietnam, and they're making their native dishes. In Nashville, the Kurdish people are importing brands of food that they're familiar with from the Middle East. And there's all these wonderful Chinese and Vietnamese market that are bringing in the ingredients that people need to make their dishes authentic.
Now, you, in this book, you've organized it by your introduction, The Keepers of the Flame refers to the old traditions. Then you have another three sections, Seeking the American Dream, and you focus on Mexico, Cuba, Haiti, Dominican Republic, and Kurds. The second part is Living the American Dream, and then you do Central and South America, Vietnam, Bosnia, and the Indian subcontinent, Japan and South Korea, and then part three is bringing tradition to the table, China, kosher, Europe, and Africa. And each of these recipes in each of these sections is prefaced by a profile of the person and his story or her story, and then an explanation of the dish, and then the recipe. You also add a section where, what's it called, where you could modify it? Kitchen passport?
Those are called the kitchen passport.
Right.
Yes.
So you cram a lot of information into this one cookbook.
We did try to, yes.
And it was quite a work. Before we went on the air, I guess you said you spent 3 years on this altogether?
We did.
And you're still happily married? And that's
we
amazing.
Are.
How did you find these people? Did you just do word of mouth and research, or what did you do?
A lot of word-of-mouth research, a lot of internet research. Probably about, before we ever started traveling, we spent about 6 months doing research, and we built a database with approximately 800 places that looked promising just on the surface, and then we started digging a little deeper and finding the places that really looked good. And then really what it boiled down to narrowing it down to these 40 people, we wanted the people who had the best stories, the people that you'd really want to sit down and have dinner with.
Well, what are some of your favorite of those stories?
Oh, there's so many. The gentleman from Cuba and their harrowing escapes from the island are just amazing, and how happy they are to be here, and how one of them talked to us about never having celebrated Christmas until he was here in Atlanta with his American, well, not American, but American living cousin. Another lady is from Liberia, and it's an absolutely amazing story from American history. Her grandmother, her great-grandmother, rather, was a freed slave from the area near Richmond, Virginia.
Wow.
And then
she went to Liberia, okay.
She went to Liberia, and then when the Civil War began in Liberia, Chef Mamusu left the country and came back to the United States and back to Richmond, Virginia. And it's just an absolutely wonderful story, and how this whole recycling of food, how we know that Southern food was influenced so profoundly by the enslaved Africans.
Oh, sure.
And then so many of those people went back to Africa and influenced African cuisine with the things that they had developed, the ingredients they found in the South. And now she's coming back.
That's really fascinating, yeah.
You know, just wonderful.
You included one of our favorite chefs, Alon Shaya.
Oh, yes, he's wonderful.
Yes.
Now, he's a bit different than many of the people in your book, though.
Oh, yes.
Because he's cooking a cuisine that is, in fact,
it's Italian.
Very, very, very familiar to Americans. And so it's amazing to think that he's an Israeli. And his success, I mean, he's just totally remarkable. We had one of the most enjoyable meals we've had in years and years and years with him at Domenica.
And he's a finalist, by the way, in the Beer Awards.
Well, it doesn't surprise me a little bit.
And we're so thrilled about him, finalist for that.
Oh, yeah.
And yes, he's a wonderful story, too, though. I mean, his father left the family in Israel, came to the United States with very little money, speaking only Romanian, and just happened to meet people who spoke Romanian and people who were looking for an engineer. And so he made a life for his family here and brought Alon's mother over. And Alon, as Alon says, he was kind of going down the wrong path, and until a home ec teacher saw something in him and helped him get a job at a restaurant, set him right, and now he's nominated for a James Beard Award and has a spectacular restaurant.
Oh, we love it a lot. Oh, have you adopted any of these cuisines as your favorites to fill in? How do you use it? Do you fill in some blanks in your Southern menus, or how do you use it?
Well, I think there are definitely some of the dishes in the book that became family favorites.
Like what?
The pastel de choclo, which is the Bolivian chicken casserole.
Oh, yeah.
It's very simple to make, and it's a wonderful dish to take to potluck. Of course, our son wouldn't touch cabbage before we made the Bosnian cabbage rolls, the sarma. And, of course, after the first time we made those, now he's, can we get cabbage and make sarma? It was so much fun watching him get to experience all of the different flavors, and it was just really great.
Well, now, who do you think will be buying this book?
Hopefully, like the subtitle says, it's a food lover's tour, and anyone who loves food and anyone who's interested in the South, because we do have some fantastic recipes.
Yeah, I was going to say that. The thing that I think is remarkable is that these recipes look not only fantastically delicious, but they look like they've been researched in terms of actual working, which a lot of these cookbooks, the recipes may sound good, but they're not going to work. So
The recipes are such a wonderful part of it. We had one gentleman, he is an illegal Mexican immigrant, and he gave us two yellow legal pad pages with the most beautiful handwriting.
Really?
And perfect instructions for making the mole negro. But then on the other hand, we had a young Kurdish gentleman who had just voted in the Iraqi elections. He was so proud so excited to talk to us. We asked him for a recipe that best to represent him and his culture and his life. And he said, there's this soup that my mother used to make. It had yogurt and chicken and rice. That's what you should make. And that was all the information that Angela got. And Angela's a cooking genius, so she went to work doing tons of research and came up with Dowjik, which is the soup he was talking about, and developed that recipe. We did put a lot of effort into testing them and making sure they translated well to the home cook.
Now, I have to work on one last thought before close, because you mentioned that what's happening is people from these different parts of the world are actually growing the vegetables which are native to where they came from, or they're importing products from the countries where they came from. How difficult is it going to be for someone from, for example, north of the Mason-Dixon line, or living in Australia, or living in the United Kingdom, or living in France or Italy? How are they going to be able to get those ingredients?
I think it's going to be fairly easy. Most large supermarkets now seem to have a good selection. Here in Memphis, where we're located, our Whole Foods market had a really great selection of most of the ethnic ingredients that are used in the book. And then in most large cities, there are lots of ethnic markets, and they're so much fun to go to. And you'll find things that aren't in the recipes that you just want to take home and try.
Yeah, I'm still trying to. My local farmer's market is carrying bitter melon, and I don't know what to do with that. Do you have any ideas about bitter melon?
Well, actually, there is a recipe on our website for hot and numbing rabbit, but on the restaurant that inspired that recipe, they actually serve a hot and numbing bitter melon. So I would think the same preparation would work with bitter melon.
Oh, great. All right. I've had it in soup in a Chinese restaurant, and that's all.
Now, you mentioned something just now that we should emphasize.
So
in addition to the obtaining a copy of The World in a Skillet, there's a more dynamic way of keeping in touch with the Knipples. Tell our listeners where that is.
Go to worldinaskillet.com. And one thing that we did was we developed lots of recipes that there weren't room for in the book. So we've been gradually posting
those. Oh, that's good.
To give folks an even greater taste of the things we got to experience.
Can people also say something like, I've got this thing?
What do I do with it?
What do I do with it that's in tune with the rest of the book?
You definitely can, yes. Send us an email, and we would love to hear from folks and love to help folks out.
And the email address is?
You can send it to panda@paulandangela.net.
Okay, P&A, huh?
P&A, yep.
Okay, and no listeners, there is no recipe for deep-fried panda.
No.
No, we don't go there.
You don't go there. That kind of scares. Probably doesn't taste. Probably tastes about as good as guinea pig.
Yeah,
if you're in Peru. Well, it's been a delight to.
I wish you all the luck of the world with this book too.
And thank you for revealing this New South in a different way, because people talk about the New South, they're generally talking about something different. It's wonderful to see that the New South is still emulating the melting pot that this nation has been, and we're all the richer for it. I'm sure you would agree.
Oh, definitely. And thank you so much for having us on.
Well, thank you.
Great, guys. Bye-bye. Just as a final note, just in case you think The World on a Skillet is really a sort of a minor event, and not the trend that's talked about is not really all that important, one of the characters who's covered in the book is a wonderful chef called Alon Shire,
Who's an Israeli.
Cooking Italian in New Orleans.
And
to close out the theme from the beginning of today's program, he's a nominee for a finalist.
In the James Beard Best Chef South.
And we're pulling for you, Alon, because we've been to Domenica, so we know how good it is. We're sure if many of the other judges went there too, then they'll be voting for you, and we'll be seeing you after you win your award in New York City. Let's hope so.
And there are other Southern chefs, of course, in the finals.
So
another favorite of ours, Donald Link, who we adore.
Yeah, but he's just such a cool young man, and such a wonderful story to be able to rise from all the disadvantages that he had starting out. Anyway, that's all for this week. As I mentioned earlier in the program, or maybe we didn't, we'll be back covering the London dining scene next week. So we hope you'll join us again, same time, same place.
Bye-bye.